Hey guys, it's Jill. Jen and I wanted to give you a heads up about the content on today's episode. It may be triggering for more sensitive audiences. Refer to the show notes for more specifics. And take care while you listen. On this episode of Common Mystics, we delve into an 1897 murder on the island of Kauai. Join us as we explore the crime, the trial, and the broader context of this unforgettable chapter in Hawaiian history. I'm Jennifer James.
I'm Jill Stanley.
We're psychics.
We're sisters.
We are common mystics. We find extraordinary stories in ordinary places. And today, we go to Hawaii.
Yay! Very fun. Okay. We were in Maui, or on Maui, Hawaii. Let's do a short recap of how we got there and what our experience was on the island of Maui.
We did not have a resort experience.
No, we're poor.
Yeah. We did not do the resort or the typical touristy things. Fact is, we have a friend who vacations there every year. And when she's there, she lives like a local. So we did local things. We went to the beach every day. We hung out at the condo. We cooked on the grill. We went to happy hour. We hung out at the pool. It was very low key. Honestly, the most expensive thing was the plane ticket.
True. Very true.
Yeah. So that was amazing. And thank you to Lisa, our friend, for inviting us.
Thank you, Lisa. It was really nice. It was just a vacation we needed and like once in a lifetime opportunity. Truly. Very cool.
It was. But we didn't have a car.
We didn't. We had to rely on poor little Lisa to take us around the island.
Right. Thank you, Lisa.
And we can be really annoying.
So annoying.
So we had to be very conscious. Like, we couldn't be like, turn here. What are you doing? Why aren't you listening? So we had to be very like, okay.
And we only fought a little bit in front of her. Just a little.
Yes, just a little.
Yeah, just a little.
I was being a little inconsiderate.
That's
I wasn't
all right.
Thinking.
That's okay. That's okay. So it was a different experience, but it was so cool. I want to just get right into it. Jill, do you want to tell us about some of our hits that we were feeling?
Yes, I was feeling... My overall experience of Maui was the feeling of Fern Gully, the movie Fern Gully from the 90s.
1992.
Yes. And right. That movie is about a rainforest that's in danger because people are encroaching in on the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like taking the natural resources there.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We were both picking up on sugarcane and sugarcane fields.
Mm-hmm.
You had a really interesting hit that didn't make sense until I started the research.
Tell me.
It was when you were seeing cowboys, like men on horses, like fleeing like the scene of a crime.
True. True.
That would be pretty relevant as it turns out.
And you don't expect that on Maui.
Yeah.
At least I didn't.
Right. We weren't in Arizona. Our intention was that day, as it always is we asked the spirits to lead us to a verifiable story previously unknown to us that allows us to give voice to the voiceless.
That's right. Now, before we get into it, can you please give me some background on the Hawaiian Islands?
I will, Jill, and I think it's really relevant to our incident, so I am going to go into a little bit of detail. For as long as I've been an American, Hawaii has been a state. You know what I mean? So I didn't know the story of how Hawaii became a state, and I was really surprised, to be honest.
Okay. Tell me what your research has uncovered and surprised.
Okay. So first of all, you know where the Hawaiian Islands are located, right?
Kind of. I mean, roughly.
Like they're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
So
Close to the equator.
Yeah. So approximately 2,400 miles southwest of California.
That's a lot.
That's not close.
Not at all.
So for it to be a state, it's like, wait a minute. But anyway, and they were formed by volcanic activity over a hot spot in the Earth's mantle where it's like squirting lava, squirting lava, squirting lava until you have like little lava humps and the lava humps become Hawaii over time. Yes. Now, around 1500 BC, Anthropologists believe that there was this epic migration where people who are living in Southeast Asia started like getting in their boats and like looking for land. And they navigated the ocean looking at the freaking stars.
Amazing. But I think the Vikings also did that. So
I know. I'm not saying they're the only ones, but that's freaking amazing. The ocean is big and they're using stars to discover new islands. And the first islands that were settled were the Marquesas Islands, and they became settled around 200 BC. Okay?
Okay.
So think about all the people in Asia who are getting in their boats and like rowing and using the stars. Think about all of them. The ones that were the successful ones landed here on the Marquesas Islands. This
okay,
is
but
important.
I'd never heard of Marquesas Islands.
Well, they were the very first islands to be settled today. And they're today they're located or known as part of French Polynesia.
Okay,
but then,
so they're French Polynesian islands as
today.
We know them today. Okay.
Yes.
So they,
okay.
they landed there.
Yes. And then the people who are the descendants of those first tenacious, smart, skilled sailors who were actually successful, then went on to find the islands of Hawaii.
Oh my goodness.
And these early Polynesians, they brought with them their rich culture, their language, and their agricultural practices. Again, these are the successful ones. Think of all the people who probably perished at sea,
mm-hmm.
right? So these Polynesians created a rich culture on the islands. And then there was a second wave of migration coming from the island of Tahiti around the 12th century. And those two Polynesian cultures shaped Hawaiian society. And over time, chiefs emerge and chiefdoms and a religious system. All of that has been in place since about the 12th century.
Okay. So when did Europeans show up?
So the British were the first recorded people to show up to the islands of Hawaii. And you might have heard of Captain James Cook.
You know what? I didn't until I went to Hawaii, but tell me about him.
Okay. Well, he made the first recorded European contact with the Hawaiian Islands in 1778. And his arrival marked the beginning of significant changes for the islands.
Yikes. That can never be good.
Opening the door to increased European and American interactions, including trade and, unfortunately, the introduction of new diseases, which drastically reduced the native population.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's always a bummer.
Yeah, and you see that time and time again when Europeans interact with native populations who have no immunity to the diseases that have been going around Europe for a long time.
Yeah, we nasty. We nasty.
So then there was a period of unification. For a long time, the Hawaiian Islands, they had their own little chiefs. They weren't united under one until the early 1800s with a king named, give me a minute, Kamehameha.
Nice. The first.
Thank you. I've been practicing. That's why I was late getting on the Zoom. See, I was practicing my pronunciation.
Uh-huh.
Kamehameha, also known as Kamehameha the Great. He had his military and he went out and he conquered the islands and united them under one kingdom of Hawaii.
And that, you know what, is pretty late in Hawaiians, like,
existence.
History arc, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we're talking 1500 BC, and now we're in the 1800s, and now they're just united.
Now they're united. In 1810, he was able to do that. And this brought stability to the kingdom and to all the islands. He unified the legal system.
That's important.
It is. He also promoted trade with England and the United States.
Mm.
He saw trade relations as a strength with those two powers. And this centralization of power under the monarchy would last through most of the 1800s.
Okay. So.
Yes.
When did it end? You said most of the 1800s.
Yeah. So the power of the Hawaiian monarchy was undermined in 1887 when the then Hawaiian king was forced to sign a Hawaiian constitution, which came to be known as the bayonet constitution. You know what a bayonet is?
Yeah, isn't it a type of gun?
Well,
like a spear on it?
It's the sword at the end of
a gun.
Of a long rifle. Yeah. Mm. So he was forced to sign it. That's why they call it the bayonet constitution, because he didn't want to, but they like pointed their bayonets at him and they're like, you're going to sign. And he's like, okay.
Who are they? Who forced them to?
Well, they were the military that was associated with the English and American business interests in Hawaii.
Wow, we suck.
Right. And this constitution, of course, diminished the power of the monarchy and imposed voting restrictions based on wealth. And it disenfranchised many Native Hawaiians and the Asian immigrants and generally led to a lot of political instability. Is this making sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Whenever you reduce the people's participation in politics, of course, it's going to lead to instability and unrest in an area.
Right. And what's unfortunate here is you see business interests bring in military power to bully a foreign government because basically they want to take over and control the economy for their own personal gain. Yeah. So that's what was happening. It's sad. And then ultimately, the monarchy would come to an end altogether in 1893 under the reign of a queen, Lalikawaokalani.
Queen Lily.
Queen Lily is what we're going to call her.
Mm-hmm.
She was the last monarch of the Kingdom of Hawaii. Jill, she tried and tried to fight against the changes of the bayonet constitution. She saw them as immoral and tried to fight against them, but she was unable to do so.
Poor thing. And I'm sure her people were all for her trying to fight against the bayonet constitution because of some BS. Mm. Okay, so what happened to the monarchy? Where did Queen Lily go?
Well, American and European business interests supported the United States military, and they successfully orchestrated an overthrow of the queen.
Oh, Lily.
Mm-hmm. And instead, they established a Republic of Hawaii in 1894. But of course, it was a republic that was controlled by the American military and American and European business interests. So again, outside powers taking control. Mm-hmm. And then in 1898, the United States formally annexed Hawaii after the start of the Spanish-American War.
Okay. Now, the Spanish-American War was fought over what?
Islands. It was fought, yes, it was fought over islands located in the Caribbean Sea and the South Pacific. And so, of course, America wanted Hawaii.
Yeah.
Right? Because then they could have a military presence.
Base, right.
Mm-hmm. And also they wanted to continue to control the economic interest, specifically the sugarcane industry. And during this period of time too, Jill, there was this whole thing called Manifest Destiny and this idea that America had to expand. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I remember that. It was supposed to expand from sea to sea on the continent. And then it was like, but we're growing even further.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there was that idea too.
So 1898, the United States Congress, July 7th. What happens?
July 7th, 1898 was the time when Hawaii was formally annexed by the United States, and it was called the Newlands Resolution, spelled like New Lands.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, well, the government is getting fancy and naming their resolutions. No, the guy's name was Newlands. He was some congressman, Francis Newlands from Nevada. And he's like, we need to get Hawaii. And his name just happened to be New Lands.
Oh, wow.
So I wanted to ask you, like, do you think the outcome would have been different if his name was like, leave the natives alone?
Yeah.
Like Francis, back off. Francis, back off. Or Francis, we have enough.
I don't think okay. So.
I was just wondering. Do you think they chose him because of his name? Like, it just seems like some like crazy coincidence that his name was Newlands.
I just feel like your idea of funny or like ha 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 is very different from my idea of like, oh, that's so funny. That's a tickle me. That's a tickle me, Timbers.
All right, fine. Let's keep going.
Okay. So let's get back to it. 1897. Was everyone in agreement with the annexation of Hawaii?
Oh my God, I'm so glad you asked me.
Mm.
Let's start with Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
On the islands, the Hawaiian people were vehemently opposed.
Yeah, why would they want to
be? Yeah, they wanted to restore their monarchy. They didn't want to be annexed to the United States.
Bring back Lily.
They wanted a government that would represent their interests. They wanted to focus on their economic future, their resources. And they also thought that this would be an erosion of their culture, of their language, and of their identity, right? They mm-hmm. wanted to preserve their ways of life.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Such a rich history.
Right, exactly. And a history to be proud of. Again, like the people who got to the Hawaiian Islands were the best of the best. Right. They were the ones who made it. They were the smartest, most ingenious, most tenacious. Like that is a culture to be proud of.
Yeah, I wouldn't go. I wouldn't go. I'd be like, bye.
No, I wouldn't either. I'd be like, I'm just going to stay here where it's safe.
Like, I don't have drama. Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't have drama, mean. Bye.
Right. Exactly.
So, in the United States, were we unified over the annexation of Hawaii?
Believe it or not, we were not. It was actually a hotly debated topic for about 4 years.
I love when you were researching this. That you found a senator who was like arguing for Hawaii to remain its own entity. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he opened his mouth as to the reasoning why. And we're like, no, no, no.
Get right.
into that.
Exactly. There are a lot of reasons in the United States that critics were against annexation of Hawaii. And some were on like the moral right, in my opinion. You know, they're like, no, this is supporting the overthrow of the government there. It violates their own self-determination, and that's not okay. And then mm-hmm. some people were like, it's not good for America. This is overreach. Like, we don't have the resources to, like, put in Hawaii. So, like, let's hold back. You know, let's save mm-hmm. some money here, right?
Right.
And then there were some people, like the senator that you referenced, who were like, these are non-white people who shouldn't deserve a vote in the United States Senate.
Yikes.
And Congressman Clark of Missouri is the guy you were talking about. He asked whether Americans wanted, quote, two mongrel senators from that leprous island.
Wow. Uh-huh. See, that was the guy, like I said, we were like, you know what? He has good, yeah, he has,
yeah,
you know,
we agree. He's like, no. Let's not do it. And then he opened his mouth, whoa, racist much? Mongrel? Uh-huh. Really? Mongrel?
Too far.
Leprous? Too far.
That's terrible. Mm. So what did Congressman Clark mean by leprous? I know what mongoloid means. Mm.
Right. Well, have you heard of leprosy?
You know what's funny?
What?
Chad's, my husband's paternal grandmother's last name was Leper.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, swear to God. And they have Leper family reunions.
What?
And they'll be, yes, it's
like,
really
don't
funny.
Like, don't go. Don't go.
You would be like, oh, I'm just driving past this one. So, yeah, I do know what it means because of Chad and his family, because it's like an ongoing joke.
It's a really old disease. It was in the Bible. Shh. It is in the Bible, I should say.
It is in the Bible.
It is in the Bible.
There's a lot of parables about leprosy in the Bible.
There sure are.
Isn't that something?
So leprosy is also known as Hansen's disease. It's chronic, so there's no cure. It's infectious, so it spreads. But good news is that it's caused by a bacteria. And these days, we can fight bacteria with antibiotics.
Ain't that the truth?
But bad news was when it was introduced in Hawaii, there were no antibiotics available. And so it rapidly spread among the native Hawaiian population who had no natural immunity.
Okay, so I have a couple questions.
Sure.
Number one, how did it get there?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, how do you combat the spread of it?
Good questions. So nobody knows exactly how it got there, but it was likely introduced to Hawaii by foreign workers and traders in the early 19th century, so the early 1800s, right? So the first documented case in Hawaii appeared in 1835. And by the mid-1800s, it was a widespread problem that prompted public health concerns.
I'm sure. Social distancing, wear a mask, all that stuff, right?
Well, the Hawaiian monarchy actually took control. And the Hawaiian monarchy signed the Act to Prevent the Spread of Leprosy into law in 1865. And it actually...
My God, this is so crazy, relevant, and timely. Seriously.
I mean, I hope not. Don't say that.
I mean...
Oh, what do you know? You're psychic. Be careful. Mm-hmm. Like, seriously, what do you know?
Nothing.
Okay, good.
I meant into recent history.
Okay, all right. All right. I feel better now. Whew. Let my adrenaline come down. Yeah, so the Hawaiian monarchy recognized that this was a problem. They took control. They signed this law, and it was about mandating the isolation of individuals diagnosed with leprosy to prevent further spread of the disease. And they even set aside a place. They set aside a place on the islands where they're like, if you have leprosy, this is where you go to isolate.
Jesus. And
it was located a beautiful, beautiful piece of property, a peninsula on the island of Molokai called Kalupapa. Kalupapa. And it was chosen because it's remote and it has natural barriers like cliffs and shit, like to keep people from like getting there. And it was actually pretty effective. And in 1866, the first group of patients was sent there to live.
Yikes. That would be hard.
Yeah. You should ask me what conditions were like there.
Well, I'm imagining conditions there. I mean, we're talking about islands in the 1800s. It's pretty friggin' primitive, right? No running water, electricity, scarce. Tell me about the conditions.
No, actually, you have it exactly right. There's food shortages. There was a lack of medical care. There was inadequate housing. Basically, they just sent them there and was like, okay, good luck.
Exactly. I was thinking like, no infrastructure. They weren't like setting up beds and be like, okay, we're ready for you. They're just like, just go to the island. Just go to the island. That would suck.
Right. Exactly. But there were some religious people who came there to help out and establish better living conditions. There was a priest named Father Damien. He was Belgian. He dedicated his life to caring for the patients. And then there was also a nun, Sister Marianne Cope, who in the 1880s played a significant role with other sisters in improving the life in the settlement, focusing on nursing care, education, and just generally creating a compassionate environment. So,
but
by the
still,
way,
but still, that even with like help from the Catholics, shit still sucks. Am I right? Right.
And I'm just going to say too that Father Damien became Saint Damien and Sister Marianne Cope became Saint Marianne.
Oh, nice.
I
That's
know.
Pretty cool.
I know.
That's
I like
really
that
sweet.
Too. I know. They worked really hard to just make sure that the people who were sent there could actually live there, you know, and had some kind of care. So that's important to know.
And some kind of quality of life.
Right. Still, though, like you said, still, Kalupapa meant you were isolated from your home. You were isolated from your family, from your friends, and it was often a death sentence to be sent there.
I am sure. It would be like quarantining for life without TikTok.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because you're not learning how to make bread. You're not learning how to like craft a skill like we were doing in quarantine in our homes.
Exactly.
We were in a faraway place in an island with very primitive living conditions and no internet.
Right. Removed from everybody that you love who also isn't diseased.
Oh, jeez.
And it was and you're waiting to die because there's no cure and you know you're dying.
And you have a disease.
Right.
Like, Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Especially what I hear of leprosy, not good. Kind of owie.
It's like your skin, like,
yeah.
Rots. Yeah. Yeah. So there was a History.com article that kind of sums up what it was like. Yeah, first published on March 31st of 2020.
Which, again, timely publishing.
Yeah, exactly. I think they did this whole article on the leper colony in Hawaii during the pandemic to make us feel better. Like, mm-hmm. at least you're not being sent to, like, some remote land, you know?
Right. Like, we're just asking you to stay
and
home.
And the quote...
We're not moving your ass to the mountains.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, that was, I'm sure, the purpose of this article. But one quote I wanted to read to you from the sister who spent time there. And she said, when they, the residents of the leper colony, came here, the law guaranteed them a home for life. For some, that home for life translated more closely to a prison, however. You were brought here to die, she said. You were not able to leave the island.
Yeesh.
So yeah, it was a prison.
Okay. 1897. Let's move it back. We are amidst the political and cultural turmoil driven by the looming annexation and the harsh realities of leprosy. That our dramatic incident is now unfolding on the islands. Tell me what happened, Jennifer James.
Okay. On the evening of Friday, September 24th, 1897, just before 10 o'clock p.m., Dr. Jared K. Smith of Kaloa, Kauai, retired to his office bedroom to write a letter to his fiancée. Home with him were his two sisters, Emma and Juliet. There was a knock at the outside office door that interrupted him. He asked in Hawaiian, "Who is it?" Someone near the veranda responded with either a cough or a grunt. And as Dr. Smith stepped through his office doorway, a shot from a .38 caliber pistol struck his left side, passing through his heart and both of his lungs. Upon hearing the gunshot, Dr. Smith's sister Emma rushed from her bedroom to the doorway, where she found her brother clutching his chest with both hands. He collapsed and died within minutes. His other sister, Juliet, reported hearing horses galloping away immediately after the shot was fired. Soon, there was a rumor that swirled that the killer was a man driven by desperation after Dr. Smith ordered his wife to Honolulu for leprosy tests. Such tests often meant a life, like we said, of banishment to a leprosy settlement in Kalupapa on Molokai. And Dr. Smith was the Board of Health agent for Kauai. It was his job to follow up on cases of leprosy for the purpose of public safety. Adding to the intrigue, his older brother, Attorney General William Smith, presided over the Board of Health at the time of the murder.
Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm.
Yeah. So there are rumors right away that this is a guy whose family member, his wife, was, you know, ordered to be tested for leprosy, and he was desperate.
Like, I understand that line of thinking, but was there anything else about Dr. Smith that may have made him a target for this kind of attack?
You know, that's a really good question. But Dr. Smith, he was a white man, but he was very well regarded by the native Hawaiian community. In fact, most residents of Kaloa found it hard to believe that any Hawaiian could have committed the murder because he was so well loved.
Really? Why did they like him?
You see, he was a beloved physician. He was born and raised in Kaloa. So even though he was a white man, he was Hawaiian. And he was fluent in the language. He spent most of his childhood in the area. His father, James, was also a doctor before him and was well-known and respected as a missionary and who established a school for Native Hawaiians back in 1842.
Wow. So it's very, very interesting. Dr. Jared Smith, beloved by his Native Hawaiian community, and he had a very powerful attorney general brother. I would think that they were all hands on deck. Everyone was investigating this murder like ASAP. Tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah. On Sunday, September 26, 1897, just 2 days after the murder, news of Dr. Smith's death reached his brother, the Republic's influential Attorney General, William Smith. And as soon as William heard about his brother's tragic fate, he raced to Kalawa, enlisting the help of a team of investigators, including his former law partner, William Kinney. Kinney, acting as the official government representative, wasted no time. Mere hours after arriving, he had the alleged murderer and his accomplices in custody. Kinney would later take on the role of special prosecutor for the murder trial.
Wow, that was in short order. I'm impressed. Okay. They had a lead. What did they have in their pocket to sniff out the murderers?
Shortly after the murder, the local sheriff's department began to suspect a Hawaiian family living about 2 miles away from Dr. Smith's residence. The family was headed by Kaio Kaehia. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
I'll accept it.
Kaio was the head of the family, and he occasionally worked for Dr. Smith, so he knew him. Kaio was a mix of Malaysian and Hawaiian descent, and he lived with a woman named Pau Pau. She was a full-blooded Hawaiian woman, as well as her 12-year-old daughter, Pua.
It's really cute names.
So Kaio and Pau Pau were a couple living with her 12-year-old daughter, Pua, but also residing with them were Kaio's two nephews, Yosepa, who is 18, and Johnny, who is 16, along with Kaio's son from a previous marriage, Kapea, a 19-year-old. And it was alleged... Go ahead.
Johnny seems out of place in this scenario.
I'm so glad that I have one name that I don't have to stumble over. So don't diss Johnny. So Kaio's son from a previous marriage, Kapea, was 19 years old. And it was alleged that Kapea was betrothed to Pua, the 12-year-old. So it seems like a packed household there.
Yeah, and kind of confusing with the relations. Like, if I was doing their ancestry family tree, the computer would be like, uh-oh, no, you're crossing. This isn't right. This isn't right. Error in your tree.
Here's what happened. Pau Pau, the lady, and Pua, her 12-year-old daughter, had both consulted Dr. Smith for their illnesses.
Oh, no.
And Dr. Smith, after seeing them both, instructed the woman and her 12-year-old daughter to undergo examinations at the leprosy hospital in Honolulu. Pau Pau's condition was bad. She had already lost a toe from the disease. So it was pretty much a done deal. Like, this wasn't mild. Like, her body parts were falling off.
Oh, God.
And their confinement at Kalaupapa, the leprosy colony, it really seemed like a done deal. So authorities believed that Dr. Smith's orders provided Kapea and Kaio very strong motives for the killing.
I would literally, like, tape my toe back on. I'd be like, what are you talking about? It's fine. Like, wiggle them and be like, I'm fine. I'm good.
Jill.
Be like, Mr. Smith, you are mistaken, doctor.
They obviously went to go see him because they knew they were bad.
Well, and probably they didn't want to infect the people that they loved too, right?
Yeah. So, however, despite extensive questioning by detectives and the attorney general, members of the family steadfastly maintained that they were all home at the night of the murder. So they were like, this is fishy. And then they go and talk to him, and everybody, like, they set them all down one at a time, all six of the people living in the household. And all of them were like, nope, we were all home. Nope, I didn't know. You know what I mean?
I would do that too. I'd be like, whip me the whole time.
Right.
Didn't see. What had happened was we had watched a movie, we had some popcorn, and then we went to bed.
We all went to bed early. But we have the victim's powerful brother who brings this powerful law friend, right? And William Kinney, his powerful attorney friend, really, like, brings on the intensity with the investigating. And he sits down Johnny, 16-year-old Johnny, and he really like digs into him. And he's like, all right, Johnny's going to crack. And all the English language newspapers during this time are like, ooh, Kenny really muddled him up and scared him to death. And mm-hmm. Johnny talked. Johnny talked. And through his relentless questioning, which, you know what? I don't know how ethical or moral that is. You know what I mean? To come down on a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Because
as a matter of fact, that happened. No, I'm kidding. No, that is pretty messed up.
They also...
He's 16 years old. His parents probably weren't present. And you don't know how many hours that investigation lasted. It could have been like days of being like, talk to me, Johnny.
Exactly. Not only that, he like got immunity for talking. So
like
how moral is that? But anyway, uh-huh. So
if
through
your
this
name is Johnny, especially in the 1980s, you're pretty well
you're a bad
known
guy.
To be the villain. Yeah.
Yeah. You are a bad
exactly.
guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Kenny discovered through his relentless questioning that the two of the young men had been out of the house that night of the murder.
Mm-mm.
And suspicion was on 19-year-old Capea, who was purportedly engaged to the 12-year-old Pua. And it was he who was... the one believed to have fired the fatal shot.
Okay, I need you to tell me about the canary and what he was singing to the cops.
The young man revealed that the family had planned multiple times to kill Dr. Smith.
Oh my goodness. The whole family's in on it.
The whole family had talked about it. They discussed the different ways to set fire to Dr. Smith's sugarcane field in order to like have him run out of the house and try to put out the fire. And then mm-hmm. they could kill him. Like mm-hmm. that was an actual plan that they discussed.
Mm-hmm. Don't even say
they
the next
also
one.
Talked
don't,
about setting fire to a cat.
No.
And having him run out and
too.
Put the cat out. They also discussed carrying a burning can of cow shit into the fields and simply tossing a lit match into the fields. But they talked about, this is too complicated. We just need a simpler plan.
Mm-hmm. Kids do that today. They have a paper bag full of poop, they light it on fire, ring the doorbell and run, and then you stamp on it. Yeah, kids do
That's
that.
An old gag. That's nasty.
It's so nasty.
Because then you have to like stamp on the shit, like, you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah, and unless you're shitting in the bag, it's not fulfilling. Like, if you're just picking up, like, dog poop and putting it there, it's like, I want my poop to be in the bag if I'm going to go through all that.
Really?
Yeah.
That says a lot about you. Do you realize this?
If it's just dog poop, it's not that satisfying. Like, anyone steps in dog poop all the time, but how often do you you step in human shit?
Gross.
You don't. At least I hope you don't.
I hope you don't either. Yeah, so they decided on a far simpler plan because all those plans were too complicated. So on the night of Friday, September 24th, 1897, Yosepa and Capea showed up at the doctor's home. They were cousins. Yosepa said that he held the horses while Capea sneaked up onto the veranda and knocked on the office door. And as Dr. Smith stepped out, Capea fired the deadly shot. And then the cousins quickly mounted on their horses and they took a winding route back home. They didn't go straight home. They kind of took a circuitous route, hoping to evade capture that way.
Sure.
Yosepa recounted that he and his cousin had secured their horses in the corral and concealed their pistols. And upon returning to the family home, Capea purportedly boasted. He said his gun had feasted on a man and his anger was appeased.
Ew.
Yeah, gross. By the conclusion of his confession, Yosepa had implicated not only his entire family, but also two other Hawaiian men who happened to be staying at Pau Pau's house on the night of the murder. So not only Johnny talked, Yosepa talked, and now we have the whole family in trouble.
And did they conclude on the motive? Were they... They knew for sure, like, yes, it was to prevent the women from going to Malachi?
Well, Yosepa was specifically asked the question, like, why? And he said that The family was devastated and enraged following Dr. Smith's recommendation that Pau Pau and Pua report for the leprosy examination. He said, and this is a quote, "When Dr. Smith ordered them to report for examination as lepers, we were all very mad. We talked about it a good deal, and it was settled that Dr. Smith should be killed. We thought if he was out of the way, they would not have to go to Molokai." So basically, Jill, the family believed that the doctor had not officially notified the Board of Health that Pau Pau and Pua's condition was leprosy, right? And so they thought, let's kill him before he reports it. And the reason that they thought that, I think this is an interesting side note, is because what the doctor could have done was had them arrested at that moment by authorities.
I was going to say, if they were so afraid of the leprosy diagnosis, why would they even go to Dr. Smith? Why not just stay on your farm and keep it on the DL? Why are they going to be like, here's my toe and here's my daughter. What should we do?
I know. Maybe they were hoping for some kind of treatment as opposed to isolation.
Okay, stop. Clearly the decision to murder the doctor is an extreme, extreme response to any kind of diagnosis, right? You get a cancer diagnosis, you're not like, kill him. That's not what's happening. Was the family's emotional response typical for the native people in the area at this time during this leprosy outbreak? Did they recognize separating the sick was from the healthy would be greater for the ongoing community? Or were they just like, nope, I want to be with my girls?
Such a good question, Jill. So you need to understand this family's response in the social and political context of the time.
I want to say something first, Jen.
Oh, yeah.
I do want to say, even as we look back on this story and this really emotional, to me, nonsensical response to a possible diagnosis of leprosy and having to isolate, their response did not seem far-fetched to some of the responses to vaccines today or isolating during COVID. So I just want to say that because I know I said the native population, but I don't want to make it seem like they had superstitions and they're not like up to date on medical science. Like even modern people would be like, kill them if, someone said isolate.
That is a really good point because looking back 4 years ago, when the world was in this situation, I saw a lot of very extreme and irrational behavior.
Exactly.
In that pressure cooker of illness and doubt and uncertainty. Yes.
Right.
That is a really, really good point.
So I just want to say that going forward. Okay.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. So in this context, though, in the social and political context of the time in Hawaii, it's true that the Hawaiian monarchy, Jill, did create that law. Remember I told you it was the Hawaiians themselves, the king, who said, no, you need to separate. Mm-hmm. But it was the current law. The current law was much stricter after the Bayonet Constitution, right? So the Hawaiians created this law, but when the Europeans and the Americans came in, then they're like, we are enforcing this like with ironclad, regulations in a way that it wasn't before.
Right.
Now, and so that in and of itself, the enforcement, the strict enforcement of these laws was like a knee-jerk reaction. It reminded the Hawaiians of the Bayonet Constitution. It reminded them they're not in control anymore of their own fate. And also, many Native Hawaiians saw leprosy segregation law as a tool of oppression against them, right?
Sounds and familiar.
Leprosy wasn't a crime. And yet, those who had it, who resisted the confinement, they were treated like criminals. They were rounded up. They were hunted down. They were sent away. And also, there's one more thing here, and that's culturally. Culturally, Native Hawaiians had different values than the Westerners who are now in charge of the law. So rather than isolating their family members that were diagnosed with the disease, they often chose to care for them at home, even though it meant that they might also get sick. And so, like, people with leprosy at the time, they weren't volunteering to go to the leper settlement, right?
Right.
Who would? Native Hawaiians, especially those in remote island communities, they defied arrest. And by the way, there were many incidents of violence and bloodshed that highlight this point. There were people who were going against the law, Native Hawaiians, who were not going against the law and like being these kind of like outlaws. And, you know, the government was coming down hard here to make a point. Like, you cannot be an outlaw. This is for the public good. So it's really complicated. The white authorities in charge seem to be sending a message to the Native population of Hawaii. You're going to follow these laws or you're going to pay the consequences.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah.
I'd throw my toe at them. Arrest and trial.
Yes.
What happens? Tell me everything.
Okay. Kapea. Kapea was indicted for the first degree murder. He's the one who allegedly pulled the trigger, right?
Right.
His father, Kayo, along with Pau Pau, the older woman who was afflicted with leprosy, and both the visitors that were present at their home that night, they were all charged as accessories for conspiring in the murder and attempting to evade detection and arrest. And these five prisoners were boarded onto a steamship and taken to the Oahu jail in Honolulu.
Wow.
And by the way, and this is some shit, so listen up. It was common during this time that if you were a witness for the prosecution, you also were imprisoned prior to the trial. So even though you didn't do anything, you're just being held as a witness, Johnny, Yosepa were all imprisoned in the Oahu jail alongside the five defendants. And not only that, Pau Pau's 12-year-old daughter, Pua, was also placed behind bars.
Oh, poor baby. That sucks.
For nothing.
For nothing.
For nothing. Because they were being questioned. But, I mean, honestly, for nothing.
For nothing.
And there were a lot of critics, particularly those voiced in the Hawaiian language newspapers at the time, who questioned the way the trial was being handled, Jill. Like, they were not okay with it.
Well, there's a lot of things wrong with the situation, but what specifically stood out to these peeps?
Well, the whole thing was being like rushed, like they wanted justice fast. It was moved up on the calendar to occur super quick. The trial for the Kapea case had been originally set for March of 1898 during the next regular term of the Fifth Circuit Court. However, the circuit judge ordered a special term for the court in November 1897 to hear the case. And this was really unusual because usually special terms are just called like if you didn't finish your business, not to start new business. So they moved it up months and months. And there was a lot of criticism, like why are you going so fast? And the Hawaiian papers were like, if you want a good outcome, you need to take your time.
Right. Like if you want a reliable outcome.
Right. Relax, if you want to do it right. Yes. Slow your roll. Do it right. And no, they wanted to get it done fast. I don't know. I kind of agree with that. Secondly, oh, you're going to lose your shit over this. Was the jury selection. It was very particular. Over a three-day period, more than 65 potential jurors were questioned, and they were questioned particularly on their views about the death penalty and the segregation policy under the leprosy law. Now, we will never know the number of potential jurors that were excluded because of their opposition to the death penalty or the leprosy law, But if the potential jurors were excluded, and that was significant, that raises serious concerns about jury bias.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
it does.
Also, notably, Jill, notably, only 4 out of the 12 men ultimately chose for the jury had Native Hawaiian last names.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's a bad look, guys. Way bad.
Yep.
Optics, not so good from this perspective.
Right. Even from the current, but yes.
Even then.
Yeah.
So, did he do it for real, though?
Well, are you asking me if he admitted to the murder of Dr. Smith?
Yes, Jennifer. Did he admit it? Was he like, yeah, I did it, and I'll do it again?
No, Kapea pleaded not guilty. He took the stand in his own defense. He said that he had been homesick all week with a cold, and not leprosy.
Just to be clear.
I had all 10 toes. He had been homesick all week with a cold and had not left the premises that night. He testified that his two cousins, Johnny and Josepa, were the perpetrators in the crime, not him. And he said that his cousins appeared to be scheming that week, but they didn't include him in their schemes. And according to him, he had never spoken ill of the doctor and was not betrothed to Pua, the 12th.
Well, it sounds like a clear-cut mistrial. Where do we go from here? What was the outcome?
After 3 hours of deliberation.
3 hours?
3 hours. Again, super fast. The jury rendered its verdict. Kapea was convicted of first-degree murder.
What about his dad?
His father, Kaio, was found guilty of being accessory before the fact. And, you know, the other two Hawaiian visitors that were at the home?
Unlucky SOBs?
Yeah. One was convicted as an accessory after the fact, and the other was acquitted.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Well, in December of 1897, Kapea and his father, Kaio, were sentenced to die by hanging.
That's harsh, bro.
There were appeals to the Supreme Court.
I'm not having a lot of faith in that court as of late.
Right. But despite those appeals, Kapea was put to death. At 10 a.m., April 18th, 1898, Kapea was led to the scaffold before 50 spectators. He was dressed in overalls and a cotton shirt, and his arms were bound. His calm demeanor unsettled the onlookers. Like, he wasn't nervous.
Legit would be acting a fool.
Despite facing execution, he remained composed and almost nonchalant. Even like when he got to like the platform, he was bouncing on the trap door, like testing its firmness. Yeah, I wouldn't be doing that. That's unusual. Kapea remained silent as the guards placed a black cap on him and tightened the noose around his neck. But his pride showed in his last words. He said, "Stop, you're hurting my neck." 14 and a half minutes later, Kapea was dead.
That's a long time, man. That's a long time. What about his dad?
Well, in his nearby cell, Kapea's father, Kaio, heard the rattle of the trapdoor and knew his son was gone. Just minutes before Kapea was taken from his cell, Kaio had received word that the Council of State had reduced his sentence, and he, unlike his son, would not go to the gallows.
Oh, wow.
How do you like that?
Well, I'm grateful, but I feel bad about his son.
Yeah, me too. Now, as for Pow Pow, Attorney General Smith had decided not to indict her after all.
Oh, good.
Though she remained in jail as a material witness throughout the proceedings.
Okay.
After the trial, both Pow Pow and Pua were sentenced to Kalupapa, the leper colony on Molokai. Pua arrived on December 7th, 1897, followed by Pow Pow a week later. Pua, sadly, survived only 6 months. Her mother, Pow Pow, lived 5 more years, passing away in 1902. Mm. Yeah.
This is a rough story all around.
Only 4 months after Kapea's execution, Hawaii was formally annexed by the United States. The Kapea trial and execution symbolize a society in transition where Christian morality and Western law diminished Native Hawaiian political power and cultural traditions.
Well, I can say there are absolutely no winners in this story.
Right?
Gosh, that's so hard.
So who do you think the voiceless are? Why are we telling this story?
I know you hate when I say this. This story on so many levels to me represents the stranglehold of European and Americans on the culture of Native Hawaiian society. And I feel like just the culture of the natives and the Polynesians is under threat when we go through the series of events that led us here.
I do agree with you.
I know you However, hate when I do that.
I know I do, but I mean, I do agree with you. However, I also see the other side of it, right? Like, look at Dr. Smith. Dr. Mm-hmm. Smith was doing his job, and his job was meant to protect public health and safety, you know? And sure. What I didn't say earlier, because I think you froze or something, was that Dr. Smith, when he saw Pau Pau and Pua in his office, what he could have done was contact the authorities to take him away that moment.
Mm.
But he didn't. He told them, go home, talk to your family, and report to Honolulu for further examination. But he could have had the authorities come, take them, seize them, and bring them right away. Like, he had the authority.
Right.
And ironically, the fact that he didn't was one of the reasons he was murdered. Because when the two came back to the house, they assumed he hadn't put in his report yet.
Right.
So there's irony there. But I do feel for Dr. Smith because he was a good guy. He was just doing what he knew he had to do to protect other people. So I see the other side. I see Western medicine stepping in as a good thing.
I agree. Western medicine stepping in is a good thing. I do believe that Dr. Jared Smith did not have to die. Truly.
Yeah.
I do.
That is a tragedy.
That is a certainly terrible, terrible thing and a dramatic knee-jerk reaction to the situation. However, I will say in the broader context, I feel like there was a reason why you brought us through the history of the islands and the situation that was happening.
Right.
These things didn't happen in a vacuum.
Correct. And it was the European influence that brought the disease in the first place.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we can trace that back as well. What do you think of poor Pua, the 12-year-old?
I feel so bad for her. And I kind of feel like it's a blessing that she passed in only 6 months. I can't even imagine life in a leper colony on that island. I feel bad for her mom.
She was 12 years old. She was sick and she was imprisoned during the trial for absolutely no reason. And the bigger irony for both Pua and Pau Pau was all of this, the killing of Dr. Smith, the whole trial, the whole thing didn't change the outcome. Both were going to die of leprosy isolated from their family and their home.
Such a waste.
I know.
Such a waste.
I know. What do you think of Kapea though? Do you believe him? Do you think he was the one who pulled the trigger?
I do. Do you?
I do.
I do.
I do. But shit wasn't right.
I almost feel like he regrets not saying it. Like being like, yeah, I didn't. I'll do it again because it didn't matter. You know what I mean? Like none of his reactions mattered. And I think that's right. The greatest Shakespearean tragedy of all. It's like all these people dead and yet the same outcome is applied.
I love that. This so plays out like a Shakespeare tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. So when we look at our hits, your Fern Gully movie reference is like spot on and crazy. Why are you so crazy psychic? I can't even.
I don't even know. I can't even deal with it. No, for real. That's, you know what? It's kind of a good movie. It's Robin Williams at his like. At
I've
his,
never like, seen it.
It's kind, you know, it's good. I liked it when I was 12.
Right. It's like Jill Child good. That bar is very low, and there are a lot of movies that are not watchable, even though Child Jill liked it.
I will just tell you this. When I saw Avatar for the first time with you and Dennis and Chad in the movie theaters and Juliet, I was like, this is Fern Gully on steroids. Like, what are you people doing?
All right.
Yeah.
There are no original stories anymore.
Ain't that the truth?
No, but that's an analogy. That Fern Gully premise of rainforest people trying to save their homeland against outsiders, totally an analogy with the clash of the old Hawaiian ways and the enterprising interests of the outsiders in America and Europe.
Speaking of enterprising interests, talk to me about the sugarcane hit.
Well, the murder plan initially involved setting fire to Dr. Smith's sugarcane fields So I think that's why we were picking up on sugarcane as like important, because the plan at first involved the sugarcane fields.
And what a diverse portfolio. He's a doctor. He has sugarcane fields. Like, is there anything he did not do? My goodness.
Tell me about the feeling of cowboys.
I mean, when you get that imagery in your head of men on horseback fleeing in the night with guns, that's where my mind went. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just that seems so Western to me.
And you said that, and I wrote it in the notes when we were on the road in Hawaii. And then when I was thinking, is this our story? Is this not our story? I read how they got on horseback and rode away, and it's clicked for me, and I knew we had to tell this story.
Yeah.
But there was another thing that happened.
Yes, I know. You want to?
Yeah,
say.
Tell.
No, you.
No, you. 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 I'm talking too much, please.
No, my goodness.
I took the lead on the research, and I found this one article that I actually relied heavily upon it, and I was reading it, and then you call me and you send it to me, and you're like, "This is our story," and I was like reading it already.
I know, that's so weird.
I know. So you sent me like, "This is our story. Here's this article." And I was already reading it when you sent it. So
I thought you were going to say how we were sitting looking at the island of Malachi, like every single day when we were in Hawaii on Maui, literally every day in the morning, especially at sunsets, would watch Malachi.
That's right. And we had conversations like asking Lisa and other people like, wait a minute, is that where the leper colony is? Because we had some prior knowledge of that.
I think Jenny B's sisters, you told me, had gone to the leper colony.
Oh, my God. Quick story. Do I have time right now or no?
Yes, yes. Or we can meet on Detours.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's do that. Let's meet on Detours because I have the funniest story about Jenny's sisters visiting Malachi. It's really funny. Okay. So meet us there.
I don't imagine anything about a leper colony being funny, but I'm going to trust you.
Okay. All right. We'll have that discussion in a minute. Hey, do you want to tell people where to find us?
Oh my gosh, I so do. You guys, you know where to find us. Find us at our website at commonmystics.net. Find us on all our socials at Common Mystics Pod. Please listen in wherever you're hearing your favorite podcasts. Download, like, subscribe, and share to everyone and anyone you meet.
Hey, Jill, we're up to 490 subscribers.
I know. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a big deal.
It's a big deal to us. So you guys, please, please subscribe. Please tell your friends to subscribe and follow us because we would love to get over 500. Help us out.
Oh my God. I would love to get over 1,000.
We'll get
there.
And
more. I love you guys. Thank you for listening.
Love you. Thank you. All right. Meet us on Detours on Patreon.
Love you, Jen. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been a Common Mystics Media production. Editing done by Yokai Audio, Kalamazoo, Michigan.